You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 15th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
And I'm Michael Brooks, and this is The Majority Report.
We are broadcasting to you live from the literal, but not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. The great American regression today, folks. George Zimmerman acquitted, killing Trayvon Martin. We'll talk with Cliff Schechter in a rare Monday appearance about the groups that are pushing state legislatures across the country to make it easier for people like George Zimmerman to murder Trayvon Martin and harder for African Americans to vote. We're also going to talk with Sarita McFadden, contributing writer at Feministing, who was at a demonstration yesterday in New York City, has a lot to say about this issue as well, and a ton more.
Texas State Senate on Friday was able to win their battle in the war on women. Their abortion bill has passed their Senate, and it heads to Rick Perry, who will, without a doubt, sign it into law. Ladies and gentlemen, if you were a woman, or a woman, who happened to bring in a tampon to the state senate on Friday, you had it confiscated, while others who walked in with their guns were let on right through.
Yeah, we'll get to that story. Absolutely insane that Republicans in Congress continue their war on low-income families by slashing the food stamps program. We'll get to that. Today is the Grand American Reptilian Brain edition of the Majority Report. We'll get to all of these stories. And I just want to say really quick at the outset, you know, one person tweeted me over the weekend because I was tweeting a few things about the Zimmerman trial. And we haven't covered this. Sam has basically not covered this story during the trial. And Matt and I have only covered it a few times. And look, am I upset that he got acquitted? Absolutely. No question. But the real thing to get out of this trial are the much larger issues that the trial points to in terms of our criminal justice system, in terms of race, in terms of our gun culture, and in terms of ALEC and the NRA and what they're pushing, which Cliff will talk to us about. So, you know, look, this issue is not a side issue. What it points to is absolutely fundamental to really some of the worst stains in American history and some of the worst things that we're living out right this second. So that's what we're going to attempt to tackle on today's show. I guess we'll take a quick break, and the political maestro Cliff Schechter will be joining us in just a moment.
We are back. This is the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now in a rare Monday appearance, political maestro Cliff Schechter, the head of Libertas LLC. Hey, Cliff, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Doing good.
How'd you get rid of Cedar today?
He's actually off. He's every Monday we're encroaching for the summer. Yeah.
Really? Every Monday in the summer? Wow. Lazy Cedar.
Well, or a man who just trusts his bench and knows how to delegate. Here, I'll give it a positive frame.
I'm just kidding.
I'm just playing.
Of course, he's beyond a hard worker and knows the talent that you two gentlemen possess.
First part of that, first part not true, second part totally true. He's lazy but knows our talent. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, I won't keep making fun of Sam while he's not here. I'll do it to his face.
Yeah, save your material for Friday, man. So
there you go.
We thought it was really a good idea to have you on today because you have a piece that you put up on Al Jazeera, I think it was yesterday, giving us context. I think this is so important. It's not just, you know, I think a lot of us are upset that George Zimmerman is walking away from killing a teenager with a bag of Skittles, and I think it's beyond obvious that you only could run this type of defense, frankly, with an African-American kid in Trayvon's position. So it's grotesque and disturbing in and of itself. But let's get to the broader issues, the issues that kind of circle what happened in Florida. And those issues are gun laws pushed by ALEC and the NRA. And you did a great job kind of describing what was behind this in that piece. So why don't you kind of just outline the roots of this that you were writing about for Al Jazeera?
Sure, and thank you for the compliment. Actually, this piece, believe it or not, I wrote this in March of 2012. Yeah. It just when the sort of the stories first really broke big on what had happened to Trayvon Martin in this case, and it just happens to still be very relevant today with what we're dealing with. Essentially, what happened was, you know, and this is what happens with what ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and this is a secretive corporate funded right wing group. You know, their biggest funders are the oil companies, Walmart, you know, the NRA, pharmaceutical companies, all the bad guys you would expect. And they pretend that they're, you know, represented, they have members who are legislators. It's actually a lot, very, very similar, ALEC is to the NRA. Because they pretend they're sort of a grassroots organization because they have members who are legislators around the country. But legislators pay these small dues, which amount to something like 1 or 2% of the money ALEC brings in. Almost all of it is from large corporate donations. And that's sort of the same thing with the NRA, who, of course, acts like they, you know, they represent these couple million members, most of whom aren't really, don't agree with them on most things and aren't really that active, instead of the people who really fund them, which are the gun manufacturers. So it's its own AstroTurf kind of operation.
Right.
And ALEC and the NRA got together because ALEC is like they're basically like locusts that go from state to state. Like they move on. They can't just destroy one place. They go from one to the other. So, for example, if you've seen all these anti-abortion bills being passed that look unbelievably magically similar in places like Ohio and Wisconsin and Texas and you know, all over the country, North Carolina, wherever there are right-wing legislatures and governors in control, when you see these things, it isn't just an action. It isn't like one legislature sees another one in another state and says, hey, that looks like a good idea. This is a coordinated effort, these guys. And so they had a committee that they had to do with crime and justice or some name that's kind of laughable.
Right.
You know, they have these different committees. And Walmart, of course, was a key member. And Walmart is the biggest arms retailer in the country. So selling more guns is always good for Walmart. But, of course, the NRA was on it. And they hatched this plan to start this thing in Florida, really, in 2005. Because there's a major lobbyist down there, this little troll named Marion Hammer, who was a former president or executive vice president, which is the same thing as the person who runs the NRA in the past. And she's based in Florida, and she's the lobbyist there, and that's why a lot of the worst legislation on guns has started off in Florida. And she was the one who with Jeb Bush and a Republican legislature, including some Democrats, sadly, but sponsored by State Senator Dennis Baxley, and if you want any more. And really the key here is that this whole culture is based around racism.
Right.
What Alec does, what the NRA does, you really just don't need to look any further than the fact that the guy who was a co-sponsor is a member of the, this guy Dennis Baxley, a state senator, is a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. Big guy who wanted to, them to be able to put the memories of the Great Lost Cause in their license plates in Florida. Lest you think that this stand your ground thing has anything to do with African Americans ever being able to stand their ground. It's another one. It's another code in the long number of codes for how whites can keep their power against those encroaching black masses. So that's who it was behind it. Alec, as you may know, is behind, or you may not know, so let's say it, is behind policies that discriminate against and disproportionately hurt African Americans across the country. All the assaults in different states on voting rights, those have all been discussed, agreed upon, and passed, pushed by Alec. Bills I talk about in here, such as tort reform, which disproportionately hurts poor and minorities, again, pushed by Alec and others. And then to close the loop, there's the NRA, who has board members such as Ted Nugent, who just the other day said he'd like to, you know, the way he'd like to machine gun South Central from a helicopter.
Right.
I wonder what he's talking about. He's referred to the dark continent of Africa. He called Trayvon Martin, what did he call him, a punk, gangster.
A gangster who chose the path of violence, chose the route of violence. Yep.
That's right. Ted Nugent's a scumbag racist to his core. But there's others. There's the part of the Alaska contingent, which includes Don Young, who, of course, referred to those who worked on his farm as wetbacks. You have Wayne Anthony Ross, also up in Alaska, who is so radical and right wing that when Sarah Palin was governor and wanted to name him as attorney general, the Republican legislature up there rejected him.
Wow.
He published an editorial, saying nice things about an art student who had used a Ku Klux Klan figure as part of their art. I mean, this stuff just goes on and on and on.
So really what Alec could be called the Coalition for American Feudalism, essentially.
I think that would be about right.
Again,
inevitably, this is all about white privilege. It's about wealthy white people against everyone else, as it always is with these guys, which includes religious fundamentalists who have all the top dogs. They've all cashed in and traded in anything they used to actually believe. But in the end, disproportionately, what they push hurts minorities, and from their membership and from everything else, you can see that. So, everything that happened with Trayvon Martin follows that logic. It makes sense that some guy literally saw an African American kid, 17 years old, walk by him, somebody who is older and bigger. I don't know if he's taller, but, he was a skinny kid, Trayvon Martin. He's carrying a gun. He's the guy that's called police something like 46 times before to complain about African-Americans, who look suspicious to him. He's the one who, when he calls the police, they tell him not to pursue this kid, stay in your car. He's the one who refers to him, as an effing punk and how they always get away. I wonder what he meant by that. Or these assholes always get away, I believe is what he said.
He was foreshadowing himself.
Yes. I'm sorry?
Yes.
He was foreshadowing himself, in fact. But anyways,
that's right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, he certainly was.
Yeah.
And then he chose, and didn't listen to them, and chose to pursue this kid, and shoot him and kill him. And also, let's be clear here that these guys, on the right, are sort of saying, "Ooh, Trayvon Martin smoked pot and did some of that." George Zimmerman had to get a restraining order against him by his fiancée for being violent, assaulted police officers in the past, and showed violent behavior there. And his own cousin came out and said he'd molested her for 10 years, and also claimed that he violently. inherently hated African Americans. So, you know, and that was reported by Jonathan Capehart of the Washington Post, not some conspiracy. So it's sort of, you know, what more do you need?
They also did not do a toxicology report on George Zimmerman.
That's right, because the police didn't think it was necessary. Because it was only a black kid that was dead. He must have been telling the truth.
Well, right, and that's really – so I think that is really precisely the point, because you're getting in – you're drawing this connection with Alec, with the NRA – and this is a full frontal integrated agenda. And maybe some people are genuinely white supremacist, racist, like Ted Nugent. Maybe some people don't really care. They just see that, like, you know, less black people or low income people vote. We have a better chance of winning elections. And you take care of the gun lobby because that's who contributes, you know, campaign dollars. They're just complete amoral hacks. But I think what's at root here and what in some ways is so disturbing from a kind of communications and public narrative agenda is that we've seen that this notion that there is this kind of like traditional America and all that that means, the racism, the sexism, all the rest that's embedded in that, is kind of winning the day in a certain sense and being perpetuated by these highly well-funded and very integrated lobbies. So in that sense, like, the whole premise of this being that Trayvon is not – he's not an American teenager. He's this other terrifying figure that can be stalked and killed. And
that's right.
Everything that comes around that. And then on top of that, the violence that it kind of gives a green light to in general, because you quoted somebody in your piece – I think a legislator who voted against the original Stand Your Ground legislation in Florida,
or
is he a judge?
Progressive legislator.
Right. And basically he said, look, he basically said about Stand Your Ground, quote, when someone looks at your wife the wrong way or spills coffee on you, you know, should you walk away or are you supposed to stand your ground and fight them to the death? Like, what does this even mean here? And I guess I'm drawing this connection. I'm attempting to draw this connection between how we otherize people, how we give kind of a certain privilege and citizenship to, you know, essentially wealthy white people, wealthy white males, and then this kind of delusional, cavalier, vigilante, like, oh, man, if I was in that theater, you know, I would have taken care of everybody, kind of death wish sort of fantasy that the NRA pushes. That's the kind of cultural corollary I'm trying to draw here to the policy, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, and that's completely correct. I mean, in the end, it doesn't mean that there's never going to be a case of stand your ground, and there already have been, where somebody white shoots somebody white or somebody black shoots somebody black or whatever it is. But at the core here is that when somebody feels strange to you, when you feel fear, that's all that has to be proven here, is that you fear for your life. Well, there are people probably much like George Zimmerman that fear for their life just when they look at somebody who's African American,
right?
Because they're so racist to their core. And in many other ways that, you know, that laws in the past gave license to whites to do whatever they pretty much wanted to blacks, and they weren't as explicit. You know, it wasn't explicit that, hey, separate but, you know, it was called separate but equal. So you guys theoretically should have equal facilities to us. Of course, didn't work out that way. African-American schools were much worse, and any of the public facilities that they were able to enjoy were terrible. I mean, you know, this is just a sort of extension of you fear that person, they're different, this justifies your fear and gives you a get-out-of-jail-free card. And you don't think that ties into the complete strategy behind lunatic sociopath Wayne LaPierre's efforts to sell more guns based upon the roving gangs in your neighborhood when things like Katrina hit and the police can't protect you and all the garbage he spews, you know, the gang members and the whatever. You know, we all know who he's talking about. We were just like we knew what Mitt Romney was talking about when he called Obama the welfare president. You know, I mean, these things are codes, and they're not really hard to discern. They're pretty easy. Lee Atwater in the past gave a whole exposition on how the Republicans, Lee Atwater being the former right-wing political consultant who helped Bush in the 80s and whatever, who died of brain cancer, but while he was alive sort of admitted how they had to study. They couldn't just use the N-word anymore. They needed code, you know, and that's what this is about, too. When Wayne LaPierre gets up there and says that, he's talking to old white and middle-aged white guys. Protect yourself against the blacks and the Hispanics and the others out there who would come and rape your women and steal your property, because that's all that all of them do. You know, he's playing directly into that.
You know, this story reminds me of another story I heard. Not this story. What you were saying basically reminds me of another story I heard about this this guy Raul Rodriguez, who basically went to his neighbor's house complaining about they were being too loud at a party, and basically he brought a gun and he called the police while he was on the phone yelling at his neighbors. The neighbors came outside and he specifically used certain terminology that he had studied up on and used that with the police on the phone to make it sound like he was scared for his life, when in fact his neighbors, it came out, they were doing nothing, and he shot them. There was no imminent threat, but he used certain terminology that he studied up on in the law, the same type of laws that were that are pushed by, you know, Alec and the NRA, and he was able to basically almost use these laws to get away with murder. I mean, in this case, it did turn out that because he had told another individual that, you know, if you're ever in trouble and you need to use your gun, just use these terminologies, just use these words, these terms, and you could get away with it, because they'll think you were worried for your life and you were just acting in self-defense. And when that came out, that's when his case fell apart. But I mean, like, it's just amazing to me that, like, it's not only just, you know, they're pushing for these laws to be passed for people to, like, you know, to use their guns, but there's specific, you know, there's ways to use these laws that are basically, you know, getting around with, that they're using it to get around things. Like, they're looking for a fight and learning these laws to be able to get away with doing this.
Well, basically, this is what this law serves to do, is undermine all other rule of law. What it serves to do is actually make lynching legal again. That's really what it serves to. It serves to literally go back to the days of where you'd form the mob and go and tear the black or the African Americans out of their homes and just hang them. I mean, I hate to be so brutal, but that's and plain about it. But that's what this does. I mean, it's a way of reasserting power that, you know, you used to be able to go and do that kind of thing when a guy was looking at your wife the wrong way. Now you can't. But here, we're gonna give you a free pass to do it again. I mean, if anybody doesn't think race is so inextricably, you know, linked, is such a key part of this, they're missing the forest for the trees. That's what this is about, you know. And really, that's what the whole gun culture is about.
Has there been
quite frankly, it's all a revolt against modernism and multi-ethnic, multiracial society, and sort of saying that you can hole up and protect yourself with your gun against everything else that threatens you, which is pretty much everything these days. You know, and that's way beyond, and that's what we're talking about here. And part of it obviously is a business plan by the gun manufacturers, because gun ownership has gone so far down since the, you know, in the 70s, 50% of American households own guns. We're now under a third. And younger generations, every generation you go down further in polling will show you that fewer and fewer people own guns. So they need to scare the lunatics into buying a bigger and bigger arsenal. That's how they keep gun sales going. It's the one guy who's got 20 guns. It's not the gun.
It's the Travis Bickle market.
Who is that one guy?
It's the Travis Bickle market.
How do you appeal to him? And why should we not all be afraid of the person that feels need to do that?
Right.
So I feel like we've talked about this 100 times before, and I mean, this is what you do. But I mean, I feel this case in particular has activated a number of people who previously were not really that active in sort of this gun issue. So these people, what do you say? What do we do about it?
Well, I mean, if you saw some of those pictures of some of those marches, yep. I mean, they were amazing. The one in San Francisco with the entire Golden Gate Bridge covered with people, it has activated people because look, if you're African American in this country, there's a lot of issues you're dealing with. You're dealing with housing discrimination and employment discrimination, and frankly, unemployment being higher, much higher in the African American community to begin with, and other things. So I think that this issue was one that just had sort of fallen off on the side. I'm not saying there weren't any African American groups active in this, but I think when you're dealing with so much, it's easy to forget. And I think this is the kind of case that reminds particularly African American civil rights organizations and really others of other racial groups and whatever that the kind of mercy you're at, you know, that this is sort of, in a way, this is a reimposition of white supremacy what this is.
And I think what you do is such an excellent job, Cliff, of drawing this line that these policies and these groups are the kind of modern, refurbished, rebranded version of all of the things that we understand historically were reactive and destructive forces in America, whether it's the John Birch Society or really anything else that was working actively against civil rights, that was working actively against progress, and really wants to have a segregated and more violent America. And, you know, the other thing that I think of while you're saying this is I remember I was watching – I don't remember whose show it was. It might have been Hayes, but it was several months ago during the gun control debate. And Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland was on, and then there was some kind of gun apologist. I don't remember who. And, you know, with the gun apologist, it was all like, oh, blah, 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 you know, all the familiar arguments.
All sound the same
after a while,
the same
stuff.
Really
it's all just bleeds together. And, you know, and then Elijah Cummings, who, as we know, you know, he's a very prominent congressman. I actually, my impression of him is, as a congressman is quite positive. And he just sort of said, well, look, you know, I can also speak from personal experience because a close family member was killed in the district I represent. And I think there was something that was just so stark about that because it was like, this guy is a congressman. You know, this guy is a representative in Congress. He has a lot of a certain power, a certain platform, obviously. And yet this issue is so close to him that he can immediately reference this personal experience where this other guy is, you know, blabbing on about like hand-eye coordination and bringing families together by like, you know, shooting water bottles out in a park or something.
And you see that with like these white Republicans. I don't really know how else to put it.
Yeah.
White privileged Republicans who, I mean, they literally, they're such stereotypes that they're like, they'd be laughable if it wasn't for the fact that what they're writing is so offensive. And they still are actually kind of laughable. I'm not sure if you saw the one who's being sent around Twitter today by Matt Lewis.
Oh, God, no.
Who was on Bill Maher Friday night, too, and was pretty laughable on that, too, as this sort of lily-white conservative. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, hey, it's Tucker McNear Swanson Carlson the 14th, you know? And his whole argument, of course, was how he knew what it was like to be like Trayvon Martin. He had once had people profile him based on the fact that he had Grateful Dead stickers in the back of his car.
Wow! All right, you know what we just proved, Cliff? That is laughable.
It's in the week. You need to go read it just for the comedy value of this thing. Like, you know, I was waiting for him to be like, there was this other time where I wore white before Memorial Day. And as I hit the 17th course, everyone looked at me askance. Do you understand what a joke you are? There's no self-awareness of the world that Trayvon Martin lives in. As you said, we were just talking about the segregated society. We may not be legally segregated anymore, but Trayvon Martin was walking around a gated community in Sanford, and obviously he wasn't supposed to be there because that's for the white people, you know? And this guy, Matt Lewis, I mean, he's just, you know, I'm sure he's there in his little V-neck sweater, smoking his pipe. You know, I mean, these guys are just such jokes. They're such stereotypes. They're every dork I went to high school with. You know,
I have one last question.
Who thought they had it tough because they took them till 17 when mommy and daddy gave them their first BMW, not when they were 16. So they had a rough ride.
Well, I mean, to be fair, to get you know your mushrooms confiscated before you get to a dead show can be pretty rough.
It can be. Maybe he had to go through the dead show only on acid.
Right.
When he was in college and knew that he wouldn't be arrested for it because he was white and would come out and work on Wall Street or do whatever the hell go on to write stupid columns from a white guy's perspective.
Cliff, I like that. Stupid columns from a white guy's perspective. Maybe that should be like a conservative alter ego that we could all publish columns under. Time for another stupid column from a white guy's perspective.
You may want to do a weekly thing on that. what do you say? I mean, if somebody can have that demented a perspective, there's no point in even arguing with them.
Right.
Because they're so lost. They have so little self-awareness. And so, I mean, yeah, that's what you do. I mean, but to go back to what you asked earlier, Matt. I mean, you know, with what we can do, you know, there's a lot we can do. I mean, with this new activism, there was a lot of activism around Stand Your Ground after this case first came out, and then, you know, Newtown happened, and it doesn't mean that it wasn't, you know, that wasn't obviously very worthy. It's just some of the efforts shifted to background checks and other things which are just as necessary, obviously. There are things that can be. I mean, you, first of all, stand your ground laws need to disappear. And something like 26 states have some form of stand your ground laws. They're not all exactly the same. Give you a case in point. Where I am in Ohio here, there's a castle doctrine, which is not exactly the same thing. But in my house or my car, I can shoot anybody if I feel any fear. So if somebody walks up to my window to panhandle, for example, I can shoot them and say I was scared. I thought I saw something in his belt. Blew him away. My guess is I would get off on that, particularly if that person's African-American. I'm sure I would get off for that. So 26 states have some form of these laws. These laws need to go. I'm sorry. If you can retreat the way common law self-defense has always been in the past, if you can safely retreat from a situation, you should be required to. If you cannot, then you have the right to use deadly force if necessary in self-defense. That was the way this always worked in the past. It's worked pretty well for us. Right. That's one big thing you can do. Secondly, obviously, being active just in general – in watching what white majorities and Republican majorities are doing, not in just the U.S. House of Representatives, but what's going, be more vigilant. I think a lot of that's happened around the abortion debate anyhow, but what is going on everywhere from Texas to North Carolina, these other places where rights are being taken away from minorities, poor women right now, to get active in your state. There are plenty of groups, depending upon, you know, how it is you want to get active. Do you want to fight for voting rights? Do you want to fight to get rid of stand your ground laws? Do you want to fight to make sure women have equal rights? These are all hugely important issues. These are other ways that the legacy of this case can be that we said enough. Look, the past 2 weeks, the Republican Party has reminded you and the white guys in there particularly reminded you who they are. They've blocked. They won't even take up immigration in the House. They have assaulted women's rights in numerous states across the country, and now they've cheered hallelujah on Twitter and been happy when a guy got off for shooting an innocent black teenager.
And they're also attempting to completely destroy the food stamp program. And I think what's so, you know, really vital and important about this that I'm sure that people who listen to the show already are attuned to is that these things are integrated. This is the policy agenda that pushes all of this stuff is part and parcel. It's the same thing. It's the same agenda. It's the same mindset. And like you're saying, conversely, working and kind of responding to it is also integrated and speaking to the same themes and the same things.
I mean, yeah, this is a moment right now. I mean, you know, look at some of the marches there have been by Hispanic groups. Because of an activism around immigration, look at what went on in Texas with the huge gathering around the state house as they assaulted women's basic fundamental rights to control their own health. Look at what happened with these marches in response to Trayvon Martin. These are all tied together.
Right.
This is all the old guard, shrinking rural white guys who need guns because they have small penises, who need to take away women's sexual liberation because they have small penises. Who need to assault other races, probably also because they have small penises. these guys who feel themselves losing their power and their control, and they're trying to reassert it because demographically they're dead. You know, they may keep controlling things in Alabama, Oklahoma, and Utah for the coming future, but they will have to moderate their positions, or will be watching the disintegration of a political party, a major political party, for the first time in about 150 years, which I think we are watching slowly.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Cliff Schechter, thank you so much for this enraging and important review of the reptilian brain of American politics, and we'll all keep working to do what we need to do to fight back against this stuff.
Please do. Keep up the great work, guys, and thanks for having me on to talk about this.
Thanks so much, Cliff.
Thank you.
See you on Friday.
See you on Friday, guys.
Take care. All right, folks. We are going to take one more brief break, and we'll be back with Sarita McFadden. She's a contributing writer at Feministing, and was in Union Square in New York yesterday. where there was a demonstration on Trayvon Martin, on the George Zimmerman acquittal, and we're going to get right to that in just a moment, folks. So stay tuned.
We are back. This is the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Sarita McFadden. She is a contributing writer at Feministing and a journalist. Hi, Sarita. How are you?
Hi. Oh, I wouldn't necessarily classify myself as a journalist, but definitely a writer.
Okay. Well, excuse us. Okay. A writer at Feministing and... Well, I'll say from looking at your work and looking at your Twitter feed, the generator of a lot of very interesting content in a number of different fields, all of which would be, it would take a long time to fully introduce you is what I'm trying to say. But it's great to have you on. And I just wanted to start, I guess, yesterday, I think you were telling me you were in New York, and mm-hmm. you were at a demonstration that took place in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman. And I'm just wondering if you could kind of give us a flavor of what was going on, what were people talking about, what was the mood of it, and what was that like?
Well, I had an opportunity to go to the protest in Union Square yesterday evening. I did not participate in the march, and they marched from Union Square to Times Square,
okay.
for which I think a lot of people have seen photos and feeds and vines and other like short video clips of what was happening. But when I got to the protest, which, you know, everyone was congregating in Union Square Park, which is a pretty prominent park, and, you know, for those of you guys who are not New Yorkers, but around 14th Street, that is kind of like, you know, surrounded by, you know, commercial buildings and all of that. But the
it's a very important public place in New York. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's probably the, you know, it's our town square, whether,
right.
like, you know, reluctantly so. I mean, Union Square went through so many different transformations over the years, but
right.
it has returned again to be the town square where so much activity happens. I mean, I think some people know Washington Square Park for that, but Union Square Park has become that, which is just a little bit north of Washington Square Park. And I would say the mood was steadfast, unbelievably somber, determined, and the somberness of it was like it was a particular weight. It hit me like a brick when I walked in to see the, like, you know, it was a massive crowd. I would say an easy several hundred people, and I think it built it up to, like, you know, at least maybe 1,000 or so. I would have to imagine I ended up marching or taking through the streets north of once they got to Times Square. But it was tremendous. I mean, the weight of it. You know, it was also an opportunity for a lot of, you know, I was with a couple of other parents, friends of mine who are also writers and poets, who are parents, and they brought their, you know, my friend has a one-year-old and another friend has a fairly newborn. Both one parent is black, one parent is white.
Yeah.
And just, you know, it was good to commune with each other to kind of, like, try and unpack the despairing sense of not being able to do something in a way that is meaningful to affect change so that we don't have another Trayvon Martin, even though the probability and likelihood and already evidence is such as another case in Florida with Jordan Davis. That, you know, there's it's a righteous anger and a despairing anger, and it also felt very heavy, but also a lot of folks who were like, you know, but it also gave me hope at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are living in such a profoundly regressive period.
Yeah.
If I were to say anything to describe this period, there's some definitely, we've made some major leaps and we're regressing in a way, and I don't really know how to unpack this incongruent movement. Our civil society is undergoing.
Go ahead.
We had a really powerful crowd, and I was honored to be in your company.
I want to get back to that in a moment, but do you think that's a really interesting thing? Because I just, with our previous guest, I just used this phrase of sort of like the political, like, reptilian brain of America seems to be really active right now. In this case, and in many other issues related to it, related to criminal justice, guns, reproductive health. And it does seem like it comes in conjunction with, in some respects, there was, you know, okay, maybe there was some, advancements on a cultural level, like in terms of gay rights or in some respects electing President Obama. And now it's like the response to that and the rage of that is so intense and so overwhelming. And I'm wondering, do you think that, I guess part of that backlash is natural because people who've always experienced and still do enjoy an enormous amount of privilege perceive any type of even minute change to that as somehow being a threat. But I'm wondering if in conjunction with that, when the sort of, for lack of a better word, kind of centrist conversation or a certain type of more non-ground liberal conversation devolved into kind of like, oh, we're in the post-racial moment and the new coalition and we're all, you know, we're sort of all living these very kind of cosmopolitan lives. Did the dropping of scrutiny and critical discourse around this stuff, did that also open the door for the kind of level of ferocity in this backlash, do you think?
Well, look, I mean, there are so many angles to kind of, like, unpack this really dynamic time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm of one mind that, look, if it, like, the left won, whether the last election, the left won, which was a stunner for, I think, the left. Is that, wait, we won the national election? Wait, we reelected President Obama in turn. Mm-hmm. Holy cow, that actually worked.
Mm-hmm.
But the gravity and responsibility, and there's a certain degree of naivete about that, which I think the gravity of that tremendous electoral shift where we've got the largest woman representation in Congress in American history.
Right.
Where we have a second-term African-American president, where the pushback, where women in America mobilized to such a degree to fight and challenge any threat to reproductive freedom, to the pushback from immigrant communities who've become American citizens, to that bond that we're building with, you know, folks who are undocumented and documented to try and create the America that we've always imagined her to be based off of the narrative and set of ideals we've always been taught. All of that about what we are is absolutely being challenged. So now I feel like, on one hand, we've not necessarily entered a certain degree of maturity about this conversation. There's a very childlike kind of conversation about what America is. But now there's this very adult sobering part of this conversation that we have to engage, which is our huge underbelly of a history of discrimination and denigration of bodies. There's I don't mean to go off too much on a tangent, but
this is great. Please go ahead.
But the real conversation for me has often been in my head, this strange notion when these personhood amendments started showing up in the last 2 years,
yeah,
in various state legislatures, this idea of trying to redefine what is human, who is a person, and who should be protected. If any, all of it, like this confluence of inequal justice applied to people of color in our criminal justice system, to this draconian trying to legislation over women's individual reproductive freedom, their privacy, their choice, our bodies. This is a conversation about personhood and whether or not, like, it's a multifaceted level of, like, how does the United States recognize a person, and how are they equally protected under the law? And the fact that Citizens United, that decision was such a strange decision to me. We are more willing to give personhood rights to a corporation, someone who is living and breathing in the world, we're willing to deny her personhood right over the idea of a possible person. There's just something so, it's a weird feedback loop for me. I'm like, I don't completely comprehend why this challenge. One hand, it's power, like it's a power struggle. I feel like, you know, for some reason, their conservative elements are superbly uncomfortable with the idea of acknowledging and living in a pluralistic society. And for whatever reason that is, I cannot point to a singular thing. There's a culture of how everyone is comfortable with how brown bodies and women moved in space in American society, whether it be in positions of power and in politics, whether it's positions in the workforce. There's a general rule that everyone has kind of seemed like, you know, I guess they wanted to embrace and or have accepted that that's how this is. And everything about it we're challenging it. We're trying to push forward, but if we have to push forward, of course we're going to be met with a tremendous amount of resistance. To try and push forward.
You know, like taking what you said, but bringing up the personhood amendment and just the attack on women and bringing it back to what you said earlier about, you know, how we're progressing, but at the same time we're regressing. I just think it's interesting because on a social and cultural level, I really do think we are progressing. I mean, there's still obviously a lot more to do and a lot further to go. But I think we are moving that direction. But what's going on is that the system is being changed in a way where it's regressing and favoring these voices that don't want this progression. For example, you know, gerrymandering, these voter ID laws. I mean, it's obvious to me that, I mean, yes, there's still certain people in society who feel this way, but they are the minority now, but the system has been changed so dramatically in such a way where it's basically in favor of these voices now, though. So that's why I think it feels like we were regressing in these certain aspects, because the system is behind those people who want this regression.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, primarily because it's we know how. I mean, racism in America, which is keep saying when moments like this happen, this is the time we're going to have the honest conversation about race in America.
Mm-hmm.
We are always going to have moments like this where we're going to end up saying, as default, again, we need to have a more honest and thoughtful, mature response about race in America. And what needs to be, you know, I appreciate folks who want to engage with me in, like, racism 101 kind of conversations because they've never necessarily thought about these particular questions about how how this system has been codified into our laws and our culture in a way that is discriminatory, for which they have, like, which is why we've agitated for corrective measures in our law, and certainly try and police our culture to undo this great wrong. So there's a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of folks who are not necessarily, like, you know, when we're talking about this, we need to actually look at kind of more of the minutiae of the institutionalization of racism. And certainly, that's one thought that I have. And, you know, like, for particularly, like, what was so hard, you know, which...
Sarita? Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you just cut out for a second. Go ahead.
Oh. I feel like the last week of June with the twin, well, there are so many Supreme Court decisions, and I'm still trying to understand.
Oh, yes, we feel you there.
There's so many, and, like, there are two other cases that I'm really, really freaked out about that we haven't actually entered into, like, you know, that I haven't heard amplify into the public discourse, which is the DNA ruling and a right. Miranda ruling.
Right.
Right. And when I think of cases like the George Zimmerman trial, particularly, like, you know, like, there are certain, like, you know, like, just as a more in a periphery, that we can, that every black and brown body is should be expected to be racially profiled, whether, like, you know, whether there's wrongdoing or not, and just how it works with New York's stop and frisk problem, and then how we're, and that the DNA ruling says it's actually okay to take DNA and hold on to that.
Yeah, we've covered that a lot on this show, actually. Absolutely. That's huge.
There's that aspect of how, you know, this swirling morass of stuff works together. You know, I'm not being particularly articulate about how they all, like, you know, in a way that
no, but
all
I see what you're
together.
So you're talking
they
about
all really connected, and I'm really, really terrified about what that's going to mean in future incidents where that law and that ruling and this culture all comes together.
No, I think I see the thread you're drawing, because you're talking about, obviously, there's this very long history that's a given of highly, you know, until frankly very recently in American law, quite literally institutionalized racism. There's still obviously institutionalized racism, but literally, like, there is separate accommodations, separate schools, and unequal public space written into the law. And now we have that can carried forward in all these different ways, socioeconomically and in criminal justice policies, things like stop and frisk. And then you're getting into what I think you're drawing is this connection of what were the lives that people are trying to bring into law, namely, like, mm-hmm. corporations, which have been by things like Citizens United, or the theory of life, which is an unborn child, which supersedes the rights of the woman to have discretion over her own health and body, so therefore taking her personhood out, and then the kind of day in and day out grind of everything from stop and frisk to stand your ground, which operates as a withdrawal of personhood from certain groups, African Americans, but others as well, in terms of who we're kind of according rights in a civil space. Because I think, again, to kind of draw it with this trial, there is no other. Maybe if it was a young Hispanic man, possibly the case. The fact that it became a trial of Trayvon Martin and he became this ludicrous caricature, which just on the face of any kind of basic logic or understanding of the situation or facts of the case could not have happened, is very reflective of what you're saying in terms of who's drawn in and out of personhood.
When people are ready to have the Beyond Racism 101 conversation to the Racism 2.0 conversation, or like just how it works in America, to see a pattern of how black and brown bodies are represented in these really cartoonish and ghoulish ways, for which plays on the white imagination to the extent that one would feel it's reasonable to shoot a teenager walking home.
And that anybody else would believe that this teenager, who was like a skinny kid with candy, possessed like superhuman strength and delivered like B movie dialogue, like, "I'm gonna kill you." I mean, it's an insult to common sense, is what I'm trying to say. And the fact that that fits into so many people's conception of what is common sense is definitely in my view, the kind of cultural corollary of what you're talking about in terms of the legal implications of who we're bringing in and out of personhood.
Yeah, I mean, because on one hand, there's what culture and common sense and being completely having a degree of awareness about an empathy, even.
Yes.
About what makes. Like, who is a person equally protected under law? And certainly how black Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans all fit in that category.
Right.
The other thing is that one of the things that I've been watching a trial, as much as I can. I was, as someone who's like sat on a couple of criminal cases as a juror, mm-hmm. I was really, really nervous about the state's case, because remembering what jury instruction is just for New York laws about from assault to, I sat on a grand jury and then I sat on one for a murder case.
Right.
I remember jury instruction and I remember what I was able to like follow in terms of the case presented to me. And then being really sensitive to what the legal statute even says.
Right.
I was really nervous that the state wasn't going to meet its burden.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But it goes back to, and the thing is, just how the statute in and of itself is written. This wasn't so much a stand your ground defense, even though stand your ground was included in the language of the jury instruction. Mm-hmm. This was a self-defense case. Everything about how it's written already privileges the power of the person invoking the self-defense claim.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm wondering, structurally, there's a structural issue beyond just the cultural intelligence about what the optics look like. It's
Absolutely.
Also just structurally how it's written.
Right. Well, I mean, and again, taking it with the connection we've been drawing, stop and frisk is very much a policy. It's formally in, the NYPD's metrics and in city policy, and it's been vigorously defended. Sarita, we're going to have to leave it there, but I really, really appreciate you taking the time to come on. And everybody should take a look at Sarita's work at Feministing. And why don't you tell everybody what your Twitter feed is as well?
Oh, my Twitter is at Rita Mac, RETAMAC.
And there's a link to that as well as Sarita's website, Tumblr site, on the Majority Report blog. Thanks again, Sarita. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, yeah.
All right. Thank you both so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was great.
Yeah. What it reminded me of in some ways is I read this piece a couple of months ago, and I think it was in the New York Review of Books, and it was about Pakistan. And the guy was trying to draw a parallel between this kind of growth of like survivalist paranoia in America and like Glenn Beck and Alex Jones and all this stuff. And, they're coming to get us and all this stuff. And then the fact that while that's, paranoid delusion in many respects, what we are actually doing in Pakistan is we literally do have flying killer robots monitoring the skies of Pakistan that can kind of kill people at a moment's notice. And he was like, is there some way that, like, there's a psychological projection inward of what's happening outward? And I think what's so interesting is, like, the violence that has been projected onto African Americans and to other groups, obviously, not just African Americans, Asian Americans, Latino Americans. And then the raw racial fear that you see in people like at Fox News and all these other places. I mean, of course, some of it's just cynicism and racism and all this, but there's also this genuine terror. And I think that has to be connected with some with this projection, basically.
Oh, it's definitely. I mean,
and it's stunning the level of lack of self awareness.
What we just listened to, basically, yeah. Both Cliff and Sarita. I mean, right. this is all connected.
Absolutely.
I mean, this Trayvon Martin case is not in a bubble.
No.
I mean, there's things that happened in our system, in our political system, that led to what happening. Whether it be why George Zimmerman followed Trayvon Martin, whether it be why George Zimmerman shot Trayvon Martin, whether it be how the media covered this case, whether it be how people are cheering George Zimmerman getting away with it. It's and the list goes on. I mean, and that's just from this one case that got this attention, because once again, you could bring it back even further to George Zimmerman was not going to be charged with anything. He was let home that night. He said, all right. The police said, all right, you're free to go. There's nothing to see here.
They didn't even give him a toxicology report. And I just want to say, once again, this is the point. This is why, like, this case matters, not because, you know, look, again, fundamentally, I think that there's more to do. I think the Justice Department should look into this case. But as a legal matter and as a legal process, I have my feelings of it. I think the defense was absolutely ludicrous. I think a manslaughter charge was an obvious conviction on this case. But the real reason that we talk about it and we point to this is because this is a lens for everything else we've been talking about, which is the massive disproportionate effects of violence in American society, racial profiling policies, guns, ALEC, state legislature policies. So this is – if you take the proper lens through, which I think we've hopefully done in this last hour, this is a profoundly important thing to look at, because a lot of things are at stake here.
Do you want to – I mean, yeah. Sarita brought up how, again, it's all connected, and she brought up, you know, this attack on women. Do you want
to
bring up
– Yeah, yeah. Let me get to this.
And then we'll
go
into the better half.
Let me get to this story. We'll get right into the better half. But so – and this is sort of like the Cliff moment of – laughter,
I mean,
rage.
When you think of this weekend, to me, these are the two things you think of. What happened with the Trayvon Martin case, with George Zimmerman walking free, and what this means, and this other terrible thing. These are the two things to me that you should take away from what happened over this weekend, because they're both extremely important.
So basically, right off of the bat, Texas passed the extreme anti-reproductive health bill that came to the national consciousness because of Wendy Davis's amazing filibuster of it, and her taking a stand, and but the social movement that grew around it, which we heard last week with Sarah Slaman talking to us and her work. I mean, this activated a really important constituency in Texas that doesn't want to stand for this assault on basic rights anymore. Anyways, this bill passed this past weekend in Texas, and
Friday it passed in Texas,
and of course, Governor Percocet will sign it into law, and it will, and you know, there, no surprise there. Now, coming off of the Wendy Davis event, there were some women and others. It wasn't just women. There's also men. There's anybody with a concern for basic rights was interested in showing up.
Anyone who think women are people too.
Anybody who has this radical, what was the old, I guess that was a Gloria Steinem quote, the radical notion that women are people too, showed up to protest this bill. Now, as it may be a surprise to none of you, but it still should, on some level, sound shocking. You can, of course, bring a loaded gun into this Texas state legislature because why the hell not? I mean, America, until it's, you know, not America, and it succeeds because we've elected too many minorities to higher office. But at any rate,
I wonder if, you know, any of those –
those you know, pro-choice women coming in had a gun on them. I wonder if they would have been allowed in.
Well, I think that that's – well, right. So do pro-choice women come with loaded guns? They most certainly did not. But they did come with something.
But the
which,
pro-lifers walk in with the guns.
The pro-lifers walk in with the guns, which, you know, what a surprise. But the pro-choice, the pro-reproductive health people came in with something that arguably is actually – equally as sinister.
And dangerous.
And dangerous. I mean, pretty bad. And or maybe I should say icky. Icky. If I'm trying to think like a Texas state legislator or law enforcement official.
That to me is – I don't even know what you're talking about yet. But to me, that's right on par with guns, because obviously when I think of guns, the first thing that comes to mind is icky.
Or America. But they brought in something icky. And that's right. Women who came in to just watch this session happen, register their dissent. Texas law enforcement officials screening people coming into this meeting removed tampons from women's bags. No tampons allowed.
Straight up confiscating them.
Straight up confiscating tampons and maxi pads. Now, the excuse was, we don't want any of these things to be thrown at us, which, frankly, I could think of nothing that those people deserve more than to have some of those products thrown at them.
As opposed to what those people are throwing at the women in those
As stands. Opposed to what those people are throwing. But it just – it stands to be clear. There was no evidence – there was nobody who sent a tweet who said, hey, we're going to bring go out and buy tampons. We're going to throw them at the legislators. No one said a thing. Women's bags were searched and products were removed. Now, to be fair to Texas law enforcement officials, they probably caught on to this, because the truth is that they know in their minds that if all these women are coming in with tampons – and say even, you know, two or three women don't come in and they have tampons on them, that's where the red light goes off, because either everybody has tampons or nobody has tampons, because Texas law enforcement officials know that y'all ladies synchronize together. So when I saw one of them bags empty, I knew this wasn't a synchronization, and I knew that this was an assault on the legislature. Oh, excuse me, sir. Would you like to bring your Beretta in? Please, this way. Oh, hold on, ma'am. We already saw one of you other ones coming in without one, so we know, you know, y'all ain't synchronized, so you ain't getting one by us. We're expertits in women's health. I didn't even do that on purpose. I'm expertise in women's health.
That's probably what – I mean, this is literally all women are to them. They're sexual. I mean, that mistake you made. I mean, that's literally. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, it's practically banning women from the Senate floor. Not the floor, the Senate session.
It's banning women from the democratic process
What do you do if you're a woman who wants to watch the session and you're on your period? What do you do?
Well, as I said before, they were off synchronization, so we know what was going on.
And I swear to God, I will put this marker down right now. I won't bet a large amount of money, but I would bet $5. I'll bet a burrito with Matt, although he probably won't want to take up this debate, this bet, because I'm probably right. Within 48 hours, Rick Perry will say exactly what I'm saying right now. That they knew that the pads were going to be thrown because the synchronization was off. And that's Texas. It's absolutely pathetic. And I mean, sometimes you do need to laugh to keep from crying. But that is just, it's unreal. It's quite literally unreal. I mean, there's really nothing more to add to that. I mean, people need to, I'm sure people are active there. And they're
massively active.
Sarah Slaman, everybody, but like, you just got to keep pushing, because these people will not stop. And it's very foundational. You know, I do think that the mask is off, so to speak. You know, this is not about any other kind of superficial spin. This is about control, and this is about an incredibly archaic and discriminatory worldview, which is antithetical to our Constitution and to our best traditions and to our future. So anyways, we got to move into the better half, folks. We went a little bit long, as we always do, because we care so much.
We went way
too long. We've given you way over an hour.
So you know what? You know what to do. Yeah. If you want to support this show, so not only can we provide you the next half, which is the members-only section, but also, in essence, you're funding the first half, which wouldn't exist without the members, please do. Go to majority.fm, click become a member, and support this show today. All it takes is less than
it's like a penny a day. A couple of pennies a day. It's nothing. Nothing. It's far less than your daily.
It's more than a penny a day, but
It's pennies a day. It's less than a cup of coffee a day.
Less than a cup of coffee a day, yes.
Less than your cable bill, less than any number of other things. So if you can afford it.
This show.
And this is actually a place where you will be making.
You can also support this show.
Difference.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You can also support this show by going to majority.fm, clicking the Amazon link, bookmarking it, and doing all your shopping through there. We get a small kickback. You can also support this show by liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter, subscribing to our YouTube channel. There's just so many ways. Just go to majority.fm and take a look at what you can do to support this show. We're going to the better half. 646-257-3920.
646-257-3920.
See you there. Wrong song.